Today I'll be talking about equipment that is at such a low level that I'm certainly not as proud of it as I would be if I were working on more complicated and more widely useful devices and ideas. However, it can't be more fundamental than getting down to a soldier's boots. And here is a boot, lightweight. It was the jungle boot of World War II. And I want to bring out in my talk how people that have pushed ideas and items often hurt themselves even though their ideas and items are successful. Starting with this boot, General Prosser, in a couple of years before Pearl Harbor, was the commanding general of the Panginoon Mobile Force. He'd served in the Philippines before, and rather unique among generals, he believed almost for sure that the Japanese would attack and that American troops would need equipment of a type they did not have. And so about a year before Pearl Harbor, he ordered one of his understrength infantry battalions to make a clandestine march. They used the old Cruces Trail of the Spaniards. It was overgrown, and they literally had to cut their way through part of it. Well, these troops had been in sheltered army posts. They hadn't been out in the jungle, really. And Prosser knew this, and he also knew there'd be trouble. Well, there was even more trouble than he anticipated, in that they started, well, not right then, but a little later, they came down with malaria, a number of them. They also dengue, aptly called breakbone fever. I've seen men with it, and they think they're dying painfully. Also, in the jungle mud, the leather shoes of the army, they literally fell apart. And they were apparently in good condition before they started this march, the soldiers did. On top of that, it was during the wet season, and rain clouds prevented the dropping of replacement shoes, and also dropping of rations. In those days, the army had just canned wet rations weighing about 4.5 pounds per day. Well, how did this hurt General Prosser? In those days, the army was, the officers and their wives were what amounted to a pleasant, closed society. And the wives were especially, they had a wide, you might call it a worldwide net. And here this stupid general had abused his their husbands, and some of them had malaria and breakbone fever, and there wasn't any sense to it. There wasn't any danger threatening. And so that, plus the resentment of the officers themselves, Prosser got hurt himself and his career. Well, he did something worse than that, in that he was in command of the whole Caribbean when the warning went out that should have been recognized by, say, Kimmel and Short in the Hawaiian Islands, that the Japanese might attack. This is just before Pearl Harbor. So he, being temporarily in command, did a strange thing. He decided to put his Panama force on alert, war alert. And to my utter surprise, he called me into his office and told me that didn't tell me, he ordered me to take this verbal message to General Lewis, Brigadier General Lewis, who commanded the forces on the other side of the isthmus, on the Atlantic side. And of course, I was really astonished with all the ways of sending a message that here a lieutenant was going to take this message verbally. Well, again, you don't ask questions of a general, even if he gives you a most unexpected order. And he gave me the short message. I don't remember the exact words, but then he said, repeat the message, or the order, and I repeated it. And then he said, go to the other side, that is to the Atlantic side. But his staff, his car was waiting, and at that time, it's hard to believe, but there was no road from one side of the isthmus to the other. There was a railroad. So I went, of course, got in the slow-moving train. It wound its way along, and I kept repeating this message over again. He said, don't write it down. General gave me that order. And when I got to the other side, there was General Lewis with his staff car, of course, and I got in, and he was perplexed why he'd been ordered to go to the railroad station. And the general being in his car, the flags, of course, up on each fender, they were flapping noisily, and the driver couldn't hear what I was saying. So I repeated the order to him, and he expressed surprise, but he knew me personally. And anyway, so much they did get out ammunition and got ready for a possible attack. Well, General Frank Andrews, Lieutenant General, rather, he was, as I said, the commanding general of the whole Caribbean. He was in Washington, and when he came back, all of a sudden, which was just about 2 days later, the war alert was called off. And I didn't learn till after the end of World War II, when both General Prosser and I were retired, of what had happened. Well, Prosser said that General Andrews had told him when he returned from Washington and found that the Panama mobile force was on alert, that the president would be displeased, which ties in with the idea that General Prosser had to the end of his days, that they didn't, well, the president didn't think a Pearl Harbor was possible, but he certainly wanted the Japanese to make the first aggressive move. In other words, the Japanese to attack, and getting troops on alert down to infantry, mainly infantry, field artillery also, in Panama Canal Zone wasn't the way to keep things looking normal. Well, I have no proof of this, and I just a couple of years ago, inquired through the official sources of information if they had any record of this war alert of the Panama Mobile Force. And I got word from that they could find no record of it. So what Prosser told me, he didn't want any message floating around, either during the alert or afterwards. And that's why I got this strange assignment. Well, here, getting back to Jungle Boots, mere details. this is nothing more than a really tough sneaker. Good grade rubber on the back. This is badly worn. I wore this in the Rocky Mountains, and the sole is worn down, and there's some patches and stitches on it. It has a high top with a bellows-type tongue, and with this keeps out mud, sand, and, of course, various insects. It's higher than the present hot-weather boots, which is an advantage. Your trousers don't pull out, or if they're over it, they stay tied with the tape. And they made many hundreds of thousands of these, and they were used in the jungle fighting from Burma to the Pacific Islands after they came out. But they had, of course, after the victory was won, any specialized jungle equipment like this was just forgotten, just literally forgotten. One thing that wasn't forgotten were the insoles. Here are some Saran ventilating insoles, and each pair of these boots had these. They originally had five thicknesses of Saran insect screening, which were, of course, fit the boot, and they had stitching. In fact, this is not the original one. This only has, well, this does have four or five layers. And this went on until 2 years ago. They had these in tropical hot weather boots. That's a long time, from early in World War II. And I got personal satisfaction out of the, of these, because I got the idea of ventilating insoles before the Russians attacked Finland. Of course, that was the Winter War, in which the Finns knew they would be defeated, but they fought anyway. And I went by myself. I always, when in a foreign country, if you go there yourself, you learn more about the people and what's going on than if you go with even a good friend, if you have a way of course, communicating. And the Finns, there were so many of them spoke English that I had no trouble at all. Well, I went from one end of Finland to the other, and it really was impressive to see a democratic people preparing for war, which they knew they were going to lose it. And they still intended to fight. And I learned how they threw their heavy anti-tank hand grenades, which was the same technique that the, at that time they were the champions in the Olympics of throwing the javelin. And now everybody uses the same technique, which is back behind the ear like that, and then with a snap of their whole body, and they could throw a heavy anti-tank hand grenade that way, much better than certainly if you tried to throw it while in underhand or any like a baseball. And well, up in a town, a little town called Petsamo, which is, I think it was about 250 miles north of the Arctic Circle. It was taken away by the Russians, of course, and has been for years Russian territory. And there in a little log cabin type country store, I saw some obviously insoles made of woven birch bark. And I a Finn told me they keep your feet dry. And they also, when they're standing on that far north of the Arctic Circle, below zero is just the start of the cold weather. So the idea was you had something that's springy, and when you step on it, that it has some forces some air out, and when you stop, of course, it's still air under your foot, and that's a good insulator. Well, I bought a couple of pair. Well, I only bought one pair. I wish I'd bought several. Because I found both when I was in the high Andes of Peru with a Royal Geographic Society expedition, this is just after I graduated from Oxford, that they were excellent there, and they were also excellent when I was working in jungle for Standard Oil, when occasionally I was on hot rock, and remarkably, the Army did adopt this updated version of insoles, and they kept them in the system until 2 years ago. And then they were eliminated. They made them worse and worse over the years. They have what they call, and still this is a part of the system, they call it value engineering. And value engineering consists of a manufacturer actually demanding of, say, Natick Laboratory or Defense Logistic Agency, the justification for, say, two rows of stitching around the insole. And the people at Natick, of course, they had nothing to do with this development. We developed these during World War II. And they can't justify it, so they remove one row of stitches. And Then they decide, well, justify one row of stitching. And, well, they were already fused around the edge. This plastic is fusible under heat. So they just had that. And then they demanded why, I think originally there were six layers. And you see that the manufacturer gets an advantage on this, and the people that approve it, they get brownie points, you might say, because they're saving the government money. So the item got worse and worse. They did finally, about 4 years ago, they went from three back to four layers. But then it was finally knocked out because a type of insole called the Poron insole, it's a trade name, it's made of closed cell thin rubber. And it's just cut out with a die stamp, you see. And that's way cheaper than doing this. And without the kind of tests that were conducted in before this, the ventilating insoles were adopted. Well, they just adopted the Poron insoles. And I had a friend of mine in Defense Logistics Agency sent me an inter-office memorandum that states that the manufacturers were given the choice of either continuing to use the Saran insole or delivering, these are the hot weather boots, not this boot, with the Poron. But since the Poron costs less, the memorandum states, they always choose the Poron insole. So much in detail, but this illustrates something that continues to worse than bother a lot of equipment. Value engineering. Well, here's a Mickey Mouse boot. The Mickey Mouse boot was developed starting, in fact, in World War II. I went back by and forth from Panama to Washington, in fact, five times until I went with OSS, and then I ended up in China, Burma, China. But this boot, look at it, you don't think, well, it's a big, heavy boot. But it's really two boots, one inside of another. In other words, there's an outer boot and a smaller inner boot, and between them there's wool felt in the sole and wool fleece in the sides. And of course they're sealed. Now, they're good civilian boots that have more insulation and so forth, but they don't have this characteristic. And the best description I've had of how effective these boots were, not saving men's feet, literally, was from a good friend of mine, Colonel Robert Oliver. As a lieutenant, U.S. Marines, he was in Korea, and the first winter they lost a men's feet frozen, not just a frostbite, so forth. And they also lost a number of people stepping on anti-personnel landmines. Well, you can't see it from the outside, but I've cut some of the older type of these, are potentially the same, up. And they are really made in a complicated and rugged way. In other words, to keep the felt in and the felt fleece in place without having to move around. And Battle Shoe Company had been making these boots. They had a factory until about 2 years ago. That's a long time from World War II. They had, people had, with the company, had built up a skill in making these. You could make a new factory. But when the United States, the armed forces, decided they weren't going to buy any more of these, and Battle had lost money for several years, they closed down the plant. So the cost of this boot rules it out if made for civilians. all this hand labor and special skills. But it is a shame that we didn't have but 50,000 of these boots and Mickey Mouse plus the bunny boot. The bunny boot is for dry cold up to 60 below zero, and that doesn't mean standing around or being sedentary when you're wearing them under those conditions. This was for wet cold and down to minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit. That below zero. For this Colonel Oliver, getting back to the best account I have heard of the effectiveness of the boot, they were issued to them the second winter. This is in North Korea, and they were told how to use them, and they really doubted it, its effectiveness. But he was on this Lieutenant Oliver was leading a night reconnaissance patrol into Chinese controlled area, and they crossed, or some of them got across, a little creek, and thought it was, as cold as it was frozen really solid, but it wasn't. It broke through, and they went into water practically up to their waist and got to the other shore, and they being below zero, Oliver was thinking, well, I'll have men frozen, but he trusted what he'd heard, and he put out a perimeter. It was a moonlight with clouds, and ordered the men to take off their boots, pour out the water, put them back on, which they did. And then they started out again, of course, feeling like their feet were about frozen. But they warmed up, and by the time, Oliver told me, by the time they got back just before dawn, their feet were warm. Now, there is no civilian shoe that can possibly do this. The nice insulated civilian type that we saw out there, it's nice and woolly inside, and what it even weighs, if you stepped in water, ice water or warm water, anything, I don't know. Well, what happened when last year, wait a minute, it was the deployment of our troops in Bosnia, and they were deployed wearing just their ordinary leather combat boots. Since there were some 50,000 bunny boots and Mickey Mouse boots in our stocks, and airplanes do fly, why did the commanding officers send the men in with just ordinary leather shoes? And the best explanation I've heard of this was from a sergeant who served in Germany, infantry, and he said that, well, they just didn't go out and have maneuvers when it was cold and wet and snowy and sloppy. And why didn't they do that? I didn't ask him that because I already knew why. Because if you do that, you have people with frostbite and injuries, and generals like normal people, that is, we'll say normal generals and normal captains, they know that their careers will be hurt if some of their men get hurt. So they literally, I'm sure, didn't know what they'd be up against if they got into Bosnia, which wasn't a fighting war. The Bosnian Serbs, as you know, instead of blowing our men up with landmines, including anti-personnel landmines, they told us where they were to a considerable extent. Well, here's a copy. You can't read it from there, but it's a headline article: U.S. troops battle cold injuries, and it shows men standing around in ice water. And there were other pictures of men in slush snow with just ordinary leather boots on, and it states that Lieutenant General Alcide Lanou, he was Surgeon General of the U.S. Army, and for all I know still is, he talked about numerous cold injuries. Well, nobody lost, most of these incidentally were foot injuries. Nobody lost a foot because we weren't really fighting, and there was all kinds of helicopters and trucks, and they got them out. But what if the fighting had developed? Or with no boots in sight, they belatedly sent 20,000 of the total stocks of about 50,000 of Bunny Boots plus Mickey Mouse boots to Bosnia. So that's 20,000 gone, so now there's 30,000, and there is no factory to make any more. Well, the snafus go on. Well, here's a pair of battle dress uniform trousers that I showed before, but there's even more depressing news, and it just developed in the last year. I cut off the stitched-on reinforcement, which from a medical standpoint, or just a general morale standpoint, is the worst era in these uniforms, and these were, see, here it goes right over this, it went over this whole area, down to the crotch. Here's where the seam was, and then across the whole buttocks, and even with it cut off, there's eight layers here. It's like a cord right between your legs. Well, temporarily, at least for the desert camouflaged battle dress uniforms, one General Norman Schwarzkopf, who President Reagan uniquely empowered to buy everything from special weapons to new uniforms, and he's an old infantryman, and he decided this is a very poor way to save money. Of course, the reason for these patches, and they include on the knees and elbows, was that they last longer, and in this strange economizing, that meant that the Army has to spend less on uniforms than otherwise would be the case. Although that isn't quite a correct statement, because every year a soldier now has a clothing bag allowance, and he has to buy his own uniforms and shoes and all. The initial issue is when he goes into the Army is made. But after that, unlike the system that worked for generations in the American Army, he isn't issued new uniforms or boots as they wear out. He has to furnish his own. So if they have present-day tests, which they have, in which they ask the soldier if he wants these reinforcements, well, under peacetime conditions, it's financially to the soldier's interest to say, yes, we want them. Well, Schwarzkopf had them taken off, and remarkably, in a very few months, several hundred thousand of the desert uniforms, which are the same except that they have the desert, you know, type camouflage on them, were produced and issued. But I checked with friends who worked at Natick Laboratories and other people, and they never changed the mil specs, the military specifications, even during that period. And shortly after Schwarzkopf retired, they went right back to making even the desert uniforms with the reinforcing patches. So the high-ranking four-star generals come and go, but bureaucracies continue to pursue their established patterns of behavior. Well, here's another one. I showed you these 2 ounce, well, the best ones weigh 1.8 ounce rifle bags to keep sand, dust out, and also to protect you. Well, you can use them for flotation devices and also for carrying water, emergency water. We're talking about foot soldiers. The foot soldiers are out of, well, they're out of date, you might say. Our Army is basically designed to win desert wars against forces armed like the Iraq Army was armed. One of the most penetrating and I think correct and unexpected answers I got to which I've just made a habit of asking people why they think the U.S. Army, the Marine Corps, have such miserable uniforms from a standpoint of skin diseases and comfort and protection against insects. But I got an unexpected answer from one man who is with Defense Logistics Agency. He's a Vietnam veteran. He's in the Intelligence Division of Defense Logistics Agency. That's the agency that determines what weapons. Division of Defense Logistics Agency. That's the agency that determines what weapons and equipments, right down to men's uniforms, our forces have. And he said the governing principle is, give me an enemy I can defeat. That's a strange answer to get by why they have these uniforms. And if they get the enemy they want, which is and fight with out in the middle of a desert, you see, it really doesn't make much difference what kind of uniforms they have. Schwarzkopf thought differently, I'm sure mainly on a basis of health and comfort. But that doesn't enter into these strange calculations of money saving on this picayune basis. Well, I made one error, and I said we had no rifle bags. Well, we had a few thousand rifle bags last year. Now some of our elite units do have rifle bags. And from Marine Corps officers, whom are young ones that I've gotten to know, the bags, instead of weighing, say, 2 ounces, they weigh 4 or 5 pounds per bag. Well, they're made of super reinforced heavy plastic. They have zipper closures, and probably they last, you might say, forever. And they're probably easier on the rifle when you're riding around in an armored personnel carrier or a tank, or an ordinary truck for that matter. They'll stand abuse, these won't. But they're zipper closed, and they're not, you're not think about using them for flotation devices. If you're riding around in a mechanized war, and I learned that from one Marine Lieutenant Colonel, I've forgotten his name right now, but I have it written down, and I'll put it in that in Jungle Snafus and Remedies. He said he'd court-martial any man that had his rifle in a bag when he was in combat. And in World War II, where we certainly were in combat, both the Army and the Marines, as I mentioned last year, they had 2-ounce plastic bags, and the reason they were light was not to save money, but so you could rip them off after you cross, say, Normandy Beach and go into action. And now they're going to ride around in tanks and other vehicles, and when they jump out, then why there's no sandstorm if they're out of the vehicle, I can't understand. But anyway, things change. We've all been reading about stingers recently, of the possibility of a stinger, the shoulder-fired missile, shot down the tragic plane off Long Island. I phoned General Singlob, not at all incidentally, John Singlob was the commander of our forces in Korea before President Carter had the orders prepared to get all our troops out, which would have changed the course of history in the Far East, certainly, maybe beyond the Far East. And Singlob didn't, it was leaked that Singlob was against withdrawing our troops, and President Carter recalled him, and he would have been court-martialed, except that the whole issue went to Congress, and Congress saved him. He would have retired, otherwise I'm sure he would have been Army Chief of Staff in a few years. Well, Singlob knows a lot about all kinds of weapons, so when I wasn't at all sure that any stinger, even an improved one, could shoot down that big plane and kill all those people. And you might say one bang, or maybe there was more than one bang. I phoned Singlob, and he said that although the slant range of the best stingers that we, the type we gave to the anti-communist Afghans, you know, which I'd read in a manual on it, was a 3.1 miles. That means not shooting straight up, though. And the plane was shot, was demolished by an explosion at about 2.5 miles. That is, if somebody shot from below. And anyway, that whole issue, why would anybody with, if they had an easily portable weapon, wait till the plane was out, they knew how high it would be, they'd get near an airport, and there it's the proverbial sitting duck with a stinger, or the weapons, the SAM 7s, which I think led to our development of the stingers. The SAM 7s were Russian, still some of them in circulation, shoulder fired missile, and in the last war in which we were, that is, the last. Next to last year of the Vietnam War, we lost and for the total of our planes and helicopters and those of the South Vietnamese that we were supplying, we lost 37 planes to these little shoulder-fired weapons. And Singlob, in his book, Hazardous Duty, he maintained that this was really disturbing because he could see what was coming. And I frankly thought the Russians would develop these really superior, not only anti-aircraft shoulder-fired weapons, but better weapons for knocking out bunkers and tanks. And well, I was wrong. I think largely due to this experience of a few Russian weapons of that type, they were better than anything we had. Our Defense Department got to work, and the Stinger came out of it, which was the decisive weapon in the Afghan War, in that only of the Stingers that we supplied to the anti-communist forces. They only shot 340 of them, and 340 Stinger missiles shot down 269 Russian-supplied planes, some of them Russian-manned, of course. And the Army Chief of Staff said that the Stinger was the decisive weapon of the war. Their dependence on air power, that is the Russians, was you might say, shot down by these losses. They could see what was coming. Well, you'd think that we would be not only working, which I'm quite sure we are, on better Stingers and other shoulder-fired or man-portable infantry weapons, but we'd acknowledge that foot soldiers with modern weapons are going to be increasingly potent factors in modern wars. But instead of that, we go ahead and, for example, the foot soldiers, if they're in cold countries, I just pointed out, they've lost boots that will save their feet from not only cold, but from anti-personnel landmines. And, well, the cost of a Stinger is between $25,000 and $50,000. That is a set, which they call a set. I wasn't able to find how many missiles go with each Stinger, that is, the, you might say, the tube, the launching device. That, compared to the loss of aircraft, shows what I think is sure to be a development, that especially oil-rich countries that do not like the United States, to put it mildly, are going to buy increasing numbers of Stinger-type weapons. And well, it points up to me the need to have good foot soldiers or get out of the war business. I'm not suggesting we're going to withdraw from war, but the way we prepare, it would appear to a little man from Mars or something, but that is our intention. President Clinton's actions, in effect, is part of this denial complex. Really, in effect, deny something is a danger, something is a threat, and our delay doing anything about it. It fits into the picture of also how individuals advance their own careers and help themselves by taking actions in self-interest, as it was just pointed out. That is a governing principle. In most cases, people, whether they're civilians or in the military, will act to advance themselves, and the long-range impact on the United States or many millions of Americans, that's very secondary. Well, President Clinton is, of course, has now essentially destroyed what was left of American civil defense. Of course, for years it hasn't even been called civil defense. It's been called emergency preparedness and other less bothersome names. And the elimination of our radiation monitoring instruments, that's really gone on apace. Most states have either junked or they've gone on, sold them off to, some cases, just dealers who've speculated that sometime in needing that they're sold at low prices. Well, Art Robinson, one of the things he's done is save the what were the instruments, radiation monitoring instruments, that would help the general population of his state, Oregon. They were going to be junked, and he told me that just recently, two of these much usually damned are public servants, men that have serviced these instruments, repaired them, checked to see their accuracy for several years. Two men somehow got a truck and they had just rented it themselves, and they, of course, with the batteries out of the instruments, they packaged the whole works and sent them to Cave Junction, where the Art Robinson's organization has its headquarters, and so Art's going to keep them, and that is shows you on a relatively small scale, well, that's big by my standards, something can be done about some of these ongoing tragedies. When I was talking about the dismantling of American civil defense, last May I was in Albuquerque, and I knew pretty well what the situation was, but I did phone and got had a phone conversation with a Mr. McPeak. He's head of emergency management for the metropolitan area of Albuquerque. And when I asked him about shelters, he said there are no shelters now except a few of the Air Force. Well, as you know, a few years back, they had, it's now getting to be several years back, they had not only basements and other places marked with that now forgotten, almost forgotten, symbol on the wall and all as fallout shelters, but they had water and some food, and at least they had instruments in the vicinity. And now, except for Air Force shelters on a base there, Albuquerque, they've changed definitions, and maybe this is just as good. A mark as shelters are the population thinks that comes fallout, and it might be very light fallout from, say, a single terrorist nuclear weapon or a ICBM that had been fired and had just by accident. There's all kinds of possibilities. Or you can, a few years from now, you can, could have a nuclear war in Northern Asia, or even farther to the west, and then you'd have fallout coming across the Pacific Ocean. I called it trans-Isthmian fallout, trans-Pacific fallout. When I got together the person, it was a very small meeting of specialists to go into this problem of what we should do, what the government should prepare to do in the case there was a war over there. And it comes out that the major danger would be from radioiodine. Not the short-lived ones, but the main danger is iodine 131, and that has a half-life of 8 days, a little over 8 days. So in other words, when that fallout reaches the United States, it would be at a level that deposited on pasture and on green vegetables people eat, you could get doses, especially to children and babies, that would cause cancer of the thyroid, which has occurred in less than 10 years after the Chernobyl accident. And potassium iodide has been recognized as an effective blocking agent. And the worse than sad situation is, I'm reaching for a many years old here's a bottle which is years old. I've carried it around various places, and I gave similar bottles with the instructions written on the side to my children and a few other people. And here you have a 2 ounce bottle of potassium iodide filled 60% full of crystalline potassium iodide. And the instructions that go with it is you fill it with just ordinary water, 90% full, and then you have some of the crystals, of course, will remain undissolved, and you have a saturated solution. And with a medicine dropper, the recommended dose, which is essentially the same as what the British have, is 4 drops, and for infants less than a year old, 2 drops. Well, the trouble with this is, it costs me with the chemical reagent grade, which I bought, you can buy it anywhere, 10 years or more in the past, it costs for the dose about 1 cent for a 24-hour protective blocking dose. I found that the present price, you can on prescription from some drugstores get the saturated solution, and a 1 ounce bottle with a medicine drop in it, that in the a chain of drugstores in Western, the biggest, most drugstores, $19.51 for a 1 ounce bottle, and that works out about, about 30 times as expensive for a blocking dose as if you get the crystalline form. And you can still get the crystalline form, but you have to, unlike what the situation was 10 or more years ago, where anybody could go, I bought this from a chemical supply company that sold chemicals to high schools and other people that were, needed various chemicals. Now it's controlled, and unless you or your organization is in the research business, you can't get it, but you can get it at a price that works out about for a daily dose, about 1 cent, versus many times that for any on prescription to the individual. And of course, there wouldn't be enough to go around at all. Well, that is something that certainly physicians could do, which is buy a half a kilo of it, and that's many thousands of several thousand people could be protected, which is a drop in the bucket compared to the number of Americans that would need this in the event of either an accidental launch of a big weapon or a terrorist act or trans-Pacific fallout. But going back to the situation in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mr. McPeak, the director of emergency preparedness, said they do give out all hazards information, which of course all does not include anything to do with nuclear. It's nothing on for the public on nuclear protection. I wrote these down as I was talking to him on the phone. Nothing on ways to ventilate basements that may be used as fallout shelters. Nothing on potassium iodide, no information for the general public. And he ended up by stating, he was a well-spoken man, Mr. McPeak. He said that that sort of preparedness has been de-emphasized. Well, that de-emphasized means various things to various people. So that's one thing that surgeons could do, and doctors in general, MDs, could do to help people. And I regret that the main hope is that there are more people like Jane Orient who go after the current administration on a level that has nationwide impact. Very few of us have the ability and dedications to do that, but I do think there's some use of doctors and other Americans pointing out some of these deficiencies as regard protection against nuclear dangers. However, the Army situation as regards equipment, I've come to the conclusion that until we're in a war or a big police action, you might say, in which American soldiers and Marines are losing their feet, are really getting sick, that nothing can be done, and I don't think that my writing this book, which has a lot of information, including detailed instructions, how you can take prophylactic blocking action, potassium iodide. And one of the strange things in the present information that's given out with these blocking agents, and I was really encouraged by a good friend of mine, John Hoyle. He has a disaster team, the disaster team of the state of Kentucky. And he was ordered to go to Atlanta 2 weeks before the start of the Olympics to get ready for the distribution of Atrabin, of course, against nerve gas, possible attack by terrorists, and also strong antibiotics. He mentioned what he found there, awaiting him ready for distribution against anthrax. And also they had potassium iodide, little bottles of it, and the strange thing is they didn't tell the people, the instructions have nothing about how you get babies and all if you take a tablet. It's in tablet form. No, it wasn't. It's in tablet form. And they have a mark, you know, where you can cut the tablet in half. And for all children, that's the dose for children, babies less than a year old. Well, I like to taste things or experiment with things, and when I put the first potassium iodide, a very little speck of it, it just burns. And how in the world the mother's or father is going to get that baby or the smaller children who can't swallow tablets, well, they just scream bloody murder. And there's no instructions on these official instructions for the use of blocking action potassium iodide, either back when this was written or on the packages that were prepared and were ready for distribution at Atlanta. Well, my friend John Hoyle, who he took 30 men as out of his 100 to Atlanta for this, preparing to distribute the counter medicines, you might call them, for chemical, biological, and nuclear. He was really encouraged, and so am I, that the federal government had made these type of preparations, and he got satisfaction out of getting some big backpacks and packing these in so that the men could move to the main danger area in a hurry, not counting on transportation, but just, you might say, commandeer vehicles and walk and run and get where it was needed, which is going primitive in a sensible way. So the situation remains that we're worse and worse prepared, except in this one particular, for limited use of weapons of mass destruction. And our army, repeating what I just said, it looks like nothing will be done of consequence until we suffer real casualties. Thank you, Lecter. I'm over my time, am I not?
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
You get one question.
All right. A question, please, from the...
I don't really have a question. I just have a comment. I found potassium iodide at both Photographer's Formulary and Better Photography stores.
Kodak sells a little 25-gram potassium iodide package, and Photographer's Formulary in Montana sells a 100-gram package of potassium iodide. It's a technical grade of the right stuff. The dosage cost from Photographer's Formulary is about 3 cents a dose, and the little 25-gram Kodak bottle runs about 14 cents a dose, but at least it's available.
It's available that way. Well, thanks for the info. I didn't know that.